Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, glad that you are with us. Coming up in just a bit, we'll visit the North Dakota Gateway to Science. We'll have our weekly Tech with Peck segment. We'll decode home theater buzzwords, and we'll also catch a news update from Prairie Public's news director, Dave Thompson. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and this is a closer look with the monitor. This week, we're focusing on key issues shaping agriculture across North Dakota, from financial risk on the farm to how fraud and federal policies are impacting producers and rural communities. Recently, North Dakota Monitor reporter Jeff Beach has been covering two stories that are critically important to the state's agriculture sector. One involves federal charges in a nationwide cattle investment fraud case that includes a North Dakota man. The other examines how changes to federal crop insurance may leave farmers with greater risk this spring planting season. Jeff joins us today to break down these developments, what it means for farmers, ranchers, and rural economies across North Dakota. Jeff, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
Jeff, let's talk first about the cattle fraud case. What exactly does the federal indictment allege, and how is a North Dakota resident tied into this?
Well, the indictment alleges a Texas-based company called Agridime was selling fraudulent securities and using fraudulent means to hide some transactions or hide some of the information about their company. It's a $220 million fraud case, multiple states, but North Dakota was one of the most affected states because of a connection to Taylor Bang of Killdeer, North Dakota. So Taylor Bang is a cattle broker in the Killdeer area, western North Dakota, known for having a very good reputation as a cattle broker before he kind of became involved with Agridime. Agridime kind of marketed investments in the cattle industry, basically get the profits from the cattle industry without having to do any of the work. So you were kind of investing in a cow or a calf that would be raised to market weight. Agridime would have the animal processed, and then they would market the beef directly to consumers, restaurants, that kind of thing. And so they were promising really high profits based on those investments. But eventually, Agridime was determined by federal authorities to be a Ponzi scheme where they were just taking in investments from new investors to pay off profits for old investors.
So the draw then was, I can invest money, I don't have to do the work, but I can get a payout on the backside.
Right. So some profits as high as 30%, you know, if you were a large investor, 10 to 20% was probably what they were offering to most investors. And so, but one of the things was some of the investors that I have talked to, it's not like they were given an ear tag to know exactly what cow they were investing in. So there was not a great tracking system that way. And so knowing where your animal was in the process was hard to keep track of. And of course, like what happens in Ponzi schemes is the first investors do see good returns, and then but eventually it kind of becomes a house of cards and kind of collapses.
Do we know, Jeff, how many folks in North Dakota may have been affected, or what losses may have been here?
The estimate from the state securities department was $40 million in North Dakota, so a pretty large percentage of that $220 million nationwide. I mean, a big part of that is because Taylor Bang had a good reputation, and also he was buying cattle for Agridime from North Dakota producers. So there were, so kind of another part of the losses in North Dakota are from ranchers who sold cattle to Agridime but didn't get paid.
So what actions, Jeff, have been taken by either enforcement or regulatory agencies here and nationally?
Yeah, so one of the first things that happened was, so the North Dakota Securities Department issued a cease and desist order against Taylor Bang back in 2023 for selling unregulated securities, or, you know, instead of if there had been an actual cow, it probably would have been a transaction that was legal, but kind of selling these investments, these unregistered investments, is where the state stepped in. Arizona did the same thing. One of the Agridyme co-founders was in Arizona. Those two actions by the securities departments in those two states kind of triggered an investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission on the federal level, and they ended up taking Agridyme, getting a court order to take over the company and begin the investigation into fraudulent practices, and eventually did rule it a Ponzi scheme.
So what's next, Jeff, in terms of court proceedings or efforts to recover assets?
Yeah, so the kind of the development this week is kind of separate from that Securities and Exchange Commission investigation. This one is a criminal investigation into various fraud allegations against founders of Agridyme in Texas, one of their employees or a couple of their employees, and then Taylor Bang is the other person who is one of the five people charged in that indictment that was unsealed last week. He has a court case coming up in March, a trial date already, which is pretty fast, I thought, along with one of the other co-defendants, Tia Link. They are still looking for Josh Link. He is regarded as a fugitive and has not been taken into custody or has not turned himself in to have an initial court appearance yet. So that's a pretty interesting development.
Are local ranchers and investors at least happy that it's come to this place? How have they reacted?
I haven't talked to some of the ranchers that I talked to back when this case kind of first developed. You know, I think some of them that I talked to regarding Taylor Bang like Taylor. They feel like some of them would say Taylor may be as much a victim as a perpetrator in this case, that he probably invested and lost money like a lot of the people that he did business with. So there's kind of a push and pull there on Taylor's standing. The indictment is, some details in the indictment do maybe kind of paint Taylor as, or accuse Taylor of kind of maybe trying to hide some of the transactions that federal authorities say were fraudulent or helped conceal information from investors and investigators. So wire fraud, conspiracy to commit wire fraud, those kinds of charges are what he is facing.
Joining my conversation with Jeff Beach, he's a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor. You can read his reporting, of course, at the NorthDakotaMonitor.com website. It's free of subscriptions or paywalls. And we appreciate his time with us on this edition of A Closer Look with the Monitor. Jeff, turning to crop insurance, for listeners who may not be familiar with details, what is prevented planting coverage?
Well, it's been important for, really decades in North Dakota. North Dakota is a state that has, because of its, geography and climate, has what we would call a smaller planting window than some other states. You have a shorter growing season, so that crop has to get in within a few weeks time frame, especially depending on the crop, in order for it to be able to reach maturity before the frost sets in. So we also tend to have some heavy soils, and we also have the prairie pothole region that is kind of chronically wet in recent decades. So wet springs can prevent farmers from getting their heavy equipment into the field to get things planted in that kind of short window that they have from the beginning of spring to early summer. So if weather conditions, field conditions prevent farmers from getting that crop planted, they can be covered by what they call prevented planting insurance. So if they don't get that crop in, they can get at least some some money out of that crop or out of that field that they weren't able to plant.
So what's changed now for 2026? And now, why does this really matter for risk management on farms this spring?
Yeah, so the Risk Management Agency, part of U.S. Department of Agriculture that runs the crop insurance program, last fall decided that they would not allow farmers to kind of buy extra coverage on prevented planting. So you used to be able to, you know, pay a higher premium, get an extra level of coverage. They took away that option that affects North Dakota in particularly because North Dakota farmers had used that product probably as much or more as any other state in the country and had collected on those kinds of claims pretty frequently. So it takes away an insurance option that kind of affects North Dakota farmers in particular.
Do we know why the U.S. Department of Ag removed that for farmers across the country and especially here in North Dakota?
That's a good question. I don't know if there's been a good answer given to that question. I think they would say that it just doesn't pencil out as far as being actuarially sound. North Dakota officials, farmers would say the opposite, that it does. It is not costing the risk management agency more money to offer that kind of insurance buy-up. I guess part of the other reason why the risk management agency took away that tool is because part of the big beautiful bill passed last year expanded crop insurance in other areas. Farmers are able to get more coverage for a lower premium in other areas, and the RMA, risk management agency, kind of felt that maybe was compensation enough and that the higher level of prevented planting insurance was not needed. North Dakota State University ag economists have kind of studied the situation, and they feel like, at least for North Dakota growers, that the changes in crop insurance aren't enough to compensate for the loss of the prevented planting insurance.
Jeff, in your reporting, what concerns have farmers, or I guess farm groups now, expressed about this change, especially given our state's weather patterns and, I guess, shorter planting windows?
Yeah, well, there's not much you could do this year other than cross your fingers or maybe put a few extra dollars in the collection plate at church and hope that God is on your side. There is still a lobbying effort to make that change or to bring back that extra prevented planting insurance for the 2027 crop year and beyond. But for this year, there's not much farmers can do except hope and pray. And there is still a level of prevented planting insurance that they are getting when they buy crop insurance. It's not completely gone away. It's just the extra coverage is not available.
Jeff, these two stories taken together, one we talked about fraud, the other about shifting federal risk protections, point, it seems to me, to broader challenges for ag here in the state. In your view, what do they reveal about the changing landscape farmers are trying to navigate today?
Well, one thing on the fraud front, one question is like, why were farmers, ranchers, how did they fall for this scheme? And one of the answers that was given was that, there's always the perception that the middleman is the one who is making the most profit for the least work. And so in the AgriDime situation, they were kind of saw this as a company that was helping cut out the middleman, and that they could get a higher return on their either cattle sales or their investments in cattle by cutting out that middleman. Now, the good news is that the cattle industry is one of the bright spots in agriculture right now. There are some ranchers out there who in Western North Dakota who have mineral rights that have helped provide a steady amount of income apart from ranching. But I'd say it's one of the old cautionary tales. Be careful what you're getting into. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. On the crop insurance front, I think crop insurance has become a really valuable tool for ranchers. I think the there's always going to be, the federal government is always going to be looking to make tweaks and improvements. You know, this is not something that Congress had a say in. It was not really, this particular change was not dictated in the big, beautiful bill the way some other crop insurance changes were made. You know, so it's a matter of paying attention to the details and then having groups like the Farmers Union was one of the North Dakota Farmers Union was one of the first to kind of sound the alarm on this case. So I think it's, you know, having advocacy groups there to kind of speak up for you in Washington.
Jeff, what's next for you and the Monitor relative to reporting about ag? Any stories on your docket?
Well, I'm hoping to do some more stories about the beef industry. You know, we've got calving season coming up. The beef industry is an interesting one just because it is kind of a bright spot. And everybody on the consumer side complains about the price of beef at the grocery store. But beef demand has not really diminished. And some of the more kind of boutique processing, smaller processing in North Dakota is something that's been expanding. And so it seems like people are willing to pay a premium for dealing with a processor that they know and being assured that they get high quality cuts of meat. So those kinds of, it's kind of an interesting dichotomy there. And then we'll just be looking at planting conditions going into the spring, especially as people do not have that same level of preventive planting insurance available to them this year.
That's Jeff Beach. He's a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor. Jeff, appreciate you helping us navigate changes in federal crop insurance and also seeing how justice is applied in this major fraud case. Appreciate it. The reporting shines a light on the challenges and opportunities facing rural communities, and that's a big part of our fabric here in North Dakota. For these stories that Jeff has written that do impact us all, you can check out the North Dakota Monitor. That's northdakotamonitor.com. You can access it without paywalls and without subscriptions. This has been a closer look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein for Prairie Public. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we're checking in again with the North Dakota Gateway to Science. It's a beautiful, beautiful facility in Bismarck. Of course, they do great work across the state of North Dakota, but if you want to see their site in Bismarck, it's right on the shores, I guess, of the Great Missouri River. Welcome back to Main Street. Hope Brodolsky is the STEM Education Specialist.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Hope, we have some events that are coming up that we want to make sure that everybody is aware of. Tell me more.
Yes, so we have our regularly scheduled programming, like our Gateway After Dark series. Our February 1, we actually did wine, painting, and AI on February 7th. But coming up in March, we are going to have an adult STEM camp crash course. And so adults can kind of jump into the roles of kids and see what we do during our summer camps, especially because in March we are opening our summer camp registration. And so it should be a lots of fun. We also have our regularly scheduled preschool discovery hour, which happens on the second Wednesday and Saturday of the month. In February, we actually focused on baking up science, and we partnered with Extra Balloons because they are bringing balloon bouquets and cards to all of the nursing homes across Bismarck Mandan. And so that's something that we were so excited to be a part of because we love being able to give back to our community as well. And that's where we get to spark that passion for giving, like we talked about with Giving Hearts Day, in our younger generation too. Also, on the 19th, have our dome shows in the innovation space. And so this is included with admission. And we are putting up our Digitalis dome, and people get to come and experience different shows every 15 minutes if they want to come and join us. And then our last event of February, well, we have two that kind of coincide with one another. On February 28th, we will be a part of Discover Engineering with the North Dakota Society of Professional Engineers. And that's happening at the Kirkwood Mall from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And we are working with lots of different engineering firms in the Bismarck-Mandan area. And people can come, experience it. It's a free event that's taking place at the Kirkwood Mall, and it should be lots of fun. And then when you guys are done with Discover Engineering, you can come to North Dakota's Gateway to Science. And with admission, we are including a showing of the show called Cities of the Future, and Bartlett West is helping us put this on. And it's going to be a beautiful show. I've been able to watch it myself, and it'll be on the hour starting at 11 a.m. on Saturday. And then on Sunday, we'll start at 2 p.m.
Hope, I want to go back to the summer camp thought yes. that you were talking about. I think that there are some folks who are listening who are thinking summer camp and Gateway to Science. That's an awesome combination. What should folks plan for, and maybe some good questions to ask when yes. they come to learn more?
We, for our summer camps, we're actually kind of switching it up a little bit this year because we are always trying to experiment, make things better. That's some of our core values. And so some of the best questions to ask is, how are we integrating the things that your students love into these programs? We specifically ask for student interest so we can integrate it into the week that they are joining us. But we are so excited to be able to restructure a little bit. And I'm really excited to incorporate this adult event with it because adults oftentimes don't really know what we do in our camps. It's quite rigorous because we really want to get kids into that thinking, critical thinking space. And so we're really excited to be able to bring that to adults too.
Give me an example of a typical camper day that parents might be looking forward to. When do they get there? What are they doing throughout the day? And then when does the day end?
So this year we're doing something a little bit different. We open our doors at 7:45 and we'll try to start camp right around 8 o'clock. We do have a little bit of flexibility. So our first activity is going to be a little bit more student driven, a lot of student choice. And so that way, if kiddos can't get there until 8:30, it'll be flexible. But we have an entire day of fun happening. And so we have our morning session from 8 to noon, and then our afternoon session is from 1 to 4. This is a little bit different than years previous, but we have seen the need for it to have that shift just because it's a really long day. But we do recognize that sometimes parents aren't able to get there until a little bit later. And so that last hour is actually going to become an add-on option. And it will be an opportunity for kids to kind of just decompress at the end of the day. It won't be specifically programmed hour, but it will allow kids to just kind of decompress at the end of the day, and then parents are able to come pick up whenever they need.
That's Hope Brodolska. She's the STEM education specialist at the North Dakota Gateway to Science in Bismarck. If you haven't been there, put it on your bucket list of things you want to get to this year. It's a great place. Hope, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The Missouri Valley Chamber Orchestra presents Two Worlds, One Stage, their second concert of the season, on Sunday, February 22nd at 3 p.m. at Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church. Hear North Dakota artists Laura Prokopik, Dr. Eric Anderson, and Dr. Yune Lee as they perform Brahms' Lush Piano Trio in B major. Then enjoy the string quartet in two contemporary works, Derek Skye's vibrant American Mirror and the Danish string quartet's folk-inspired As I Walked Out. Tickets are available at the door.
Still to come on Main Street, home theater buzzwords demystified. If you don't know what nits, black levels, contrast ratio, and OLED is all about, stick with us. It's Tech with Peck. Plus, we'll review the news with News Director Dave Thompson. That's after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and it's time for our weekly conversation, Tech with Peck. You've shopped for TVs or projectors recently. You've been flooded maybe with terms like HDR, Dolby Vision, OLED, QLED, Mini LED, 8K, upscaling, and maybe it can feel less like buying a screen and more like doing a tech manual. George is good at tech manuals. We've learned that when we introduced him to all of our listeners, but we're going to stick to video standards tonight. We want to understand what they mean, what they actually do to improve the picture, and what it is all of these tech words really mean? George is here to break it down for us. Welcome back, George.
I'm going to start with the story. And the story was the old Motorola black and white TV that I grew up with. I'm going to date myself. RCA had great color televisions like in the late 60s and early 70s. I was very good at finding the presents that my parents hid. And so I opened the door to our little storage under the stairs, and there was a beautiful RCA television, color television in there. So well before Christmas, I had it out, and I was watching color television. So that was my first color television story of the CRT, the cathode ray tube, the original television. So how things have changed.
My dad made a living fixing those.
Yes, he did. We used to go behind his shop and get the old ones and pull the electronics out and build stuff. I remember that. Yes.
Yeah. All right, George, I'm going to throw some terms at you that are present day and not from 50 years ago or more. Right. And I want you to tell us what they mean. And I want to start with HDR or high dynamic range.
Well, I don't think scam would be the right response, but I find HDR to, in many cases, be disappointing. So the idea of high dynamic range is that televisions now are capable of very bright pictures. So very bright whites. And particularly OLEDs, and I'm assuming that term's going to come soon.
Yes.
OLEDs are also capable of very, very dark blacks. So if you've got the capability of a very, very bright white and a very dark black and very vibrant colors in between, why not take a video signal and enhance the contrast so that the brights are brighter and the dims are dimmer? And that sounds good on the surface, and that's what high dynamic range is.
Are all HDR created equal, George?
In theory, I mean, the standard is the same, but some televisions do better jobs than others of showing it. Now, talking purely about televisions and not projectors, because it's a separate issue with projectors. But with televisions, again, the brighter the TV, then theoretically the more effect HDR has. So if you look at a non-HDR, the term is SDR, standard dynamic range. So SDR, HDR, the two words. If you look at the same video on SDR versus HDR, you will see much brighter brights and much dimmer dims on HDR than SDR. My complaint is, if you're watching film, this isn't what the filmmaker intended, because theaters don't do HDR. And so you tend to get exaggerated things. Like, my biggest complaint is everybody's eyes have this big white sparkle right in the middle of them. And it's like, oh, it's got to be HDR, because no one's eyes really look like that. So that's what it is. That is the concept. In some cases, it looks fantastic. If you're looking at a, you know, dark city at night, a cityscape, or a flyover of a city, you will see the beautiful bright, you know, lights on the Salesforce Tower, and then the deep blacks of like the river or something. So it's good in certain cases. In other cases, I think it distorts the picture too much. Personal opinion.
On to the next terms. Dolby Vision. And where does Dolby Vision fit into the HDR conversation?
So HDR and Dolby Vision are in essence the same thing. They are ways of enhancing the brightness and the contrast. There's a couple of differences. Dolby Vision from Dolby Laboratories, founded by a guy named Ray Dolby back in the old days. Original Dolby noise reduction is what he did on cassette decks, as I'm dating myself. Dolby Vision is a version of HDR that is more flexible. So Dolby Vision, by its nature, is sending metadata. That's data about the picture in addition to the picture itself. And for every frame of video that Dolby Vision sends, it sends brightness levels and contrast levels, and a Dolby Vision compatible television reads those and theoretically adjusts things. HDR sends one set of metadata for the entire program, and the television just sticks with that same metadata. So that's the kind of technical difference. Theoretically, that makes Dolby Vision better contrast, better shadow detail, handling bright scenes better, handling dark scenes better. The other difference is HDR is open source and free to TV manufacturers, and Dolby Vision is licensed. And so for that, some manufacturers don't even do it. In pure terms of effectiveness, I have tried to compare HDR and Dolby Vision versions of the same content. I can't tell the difference. So it depends, I guess, on your eyes and how picky you are, but I have not been able to discern a difference between them.
on to the term NITS.
You know, I've been called that several times.
Yeah. Yeah. I can go with you there too, George. But yeah. But NITS to me mean these little tiny things, little things that might be wrong with maybe a project. I have a little nit with this, but really, what does it have to do with brightness?
Well, and so in television and video, it's the measurement of brightness. But a television, you can get a calibration camera and hang it off the front of your television or your video monitor. And it will measure a brightness, and the term is nits. If you have a video projector, you got to hang the camera over the screen, not over the projector itself. And then the screen actually reflects the light from the projector and produces nits coming from the screen. So it's a measure of brightness.
More nits is a brighter screen then?
Yeah, more nits is a brighter screen. Yeah.
Okay. On to contrast ratio. You talked about that just a little bit.
So contrast ratio is usually, you know, expressed in a, you know, number colon one. So, you know, 30,000 to one, 100,000 to one. Contrast ratio is among, in my humble opinion, one of the many but most abused marketing terms in the consumer electronics field, in that they are very possibly manipulated. But theoretically, the first number is the brightest portion of a screen that the display can present, and then the one is the blackest. And the larger the contrast ratio, the bigger difference between the bright part of the screen and the dark part of a screen. So a really high contrast ratio means you've got super deep blacks against incredibly brilliant whites, and a low contrast ratio means you've got somewhat muted colors over a gray background.
Enjoying our conversation with George Peck. We call this segment Tech with Peck. We air it every Thursday, and George walks us through tech stuff. And now we're talking about words that we'll see when we're maybe looking to buy a TV or projector. George, one term that really surprised me was black level when I was looking at different projectors. What's black levels all about?
If we talk about it from a projector perspective, projectors in particular have a little tougher time displaying black, because the concept of a video projector is you shine light on a reflective surface. And unless you don't have any light to shine on the reflective surface, there's going to be some kind of light reflecting off that surface. So a big bright bulb in a video projector on a reflective surface is going to reflect some light. The less light it sends to the reflective surface, the deeper the black level. So from a projector perspective, the less light that reflects off that screen, the better the black level, which comes in mighty handy for, you know, really dark scenes like The Dark Knight Rises or these, you know, movies with
Batman movies. Deep
blacks. Yes.
Let's play alphabet soup, and specifically LED alphabet soup. OLED.
So LED is short for light emitting diode, which has been, in my view, one of the most incredible advancements in lights in general in my lifetime. Watching the Super Bowl, the stadium was lit with LED lights. They can turn them off immediately, turn them on immediately. I've got LED lights around my house that are cool, bright, change colors. LED's been incredible. So that's what a light emitting diode is.
And consumes less power, by the way.
And consumes less power, and it emits much less heat. So that's the term. In televisions, it is misused, as you might imagine, in some cases. But all modern day televisions have gone from cathode ray tubes to flat panels driven by some form of LED light, either emitting the pixels that make the picture up directly. That's an organic LED. Or LEDs backlighting, here's another term, the liquid crystal display, or the LCD, which actually creates the pixels. So we've got OLEDs, which actually have pixels that light up individually, and then we have LCDs with LED backlighting. And they're called LED TVs, but they're kind of LCD-LED combinations.
I've seen QLED, QLED.
So QLED, quantum LED, the LCD panel, all right, which is the liquid crystal display, how do you backlight that? Because what you're seeing on your screen is a backlight coming through, and the LCD is getting darker light and changing color. So how you light the back of that screen varies tremendously, from edge lit, which look terrible because it's bright in the edges and dim in the middle, to various numbers of LEDs behind that LCD panel. And that's where all of those terms come into play. Quantum LED has a very large number of LEDs behind that LCD screen. So you can turn more of those backlit LEDs off and then get more dark parts of that picture. So the more backlit variation there is, the more individual LEDs behind that panel, the more contrast and more control you have over individual parts of the picture.
George, we've all seen 720, 1080, 4K, now 8K when we're talking about video. I think that many of us probably have either a 1080 HD television or maybe a 4K television. And now there's 8K, George. Is it meaningfully better than 4K?
Well, I don't know. I'd have to find some 8K content to actually make that determination, Craig, and there isn't any. So the biggest problem with 8K is the consumer electronics industry needed someplace to go. So they introduced 8K television. The problem is that there isn't any content, so you can't really see real 8K. So what you would see with an 8K television is, as I think I heard the term upscaling, where the television takes the 4K video and in essence doubles it and shows it in 8K, but it's taking video and just displaying it twice. And does that make it look any better? Theoretically, it might, but ultimately native video is what we look for, because if you want the best contrast, not so much contrast, but the best resolution, the higher native resolution, the better the quality of the picture and the better the clarity. We got to get some 8K content, though, before I can give an opinion.
We have streaming services that support 4K content, George. Do you see those services bouncing to 8K in the next year or two?
No. How's that for a quick answer? No. Because I think if I can take a look at this and think about this. So SD, standard definition, which was what kind of native television was. And I remember going to it was a Comdex or some trade show. And I saw HD, high definition, and it just was so much better than SD. DVDs were SD, and then we went from DVDs to Blu-ray discs, which were HD. And the difference was just
marvelous,
staggering to me. Yep. There was a huge difference between standard definition and HD. Now comes along 4K, the Ultra HD Blu-ray, the 4K Blu-rays. I just don't see that stark of an improvement from HD to 4K. And to me, it's just, there's not going to be an incremental improvement between 4K to 8K. And my guess is that most of the industry's figured that out.
George, of all of the terms that we've talked about tonight, if I were looking for a new TV, a projector, what might be the most important one to really take a look at and understand when I'm comparing devices?
Again, I pick nits, Craig. We talked about nits. I pick them. And in particular, I'm very picky about the quality of the video and in particular, the contrast. I love deep blacks. I generally, if I'm watching something that I really want to pay attention to, I do it at night, at least if it's in my living room on a television. Mm-hmm. I do it at night with the lights off because I want that contrast. I want those deep blacks. Sometimes I even turn the brightness of the TV down a little because it's too bright. So to me, contrast, color accuracy is super important. So I have two OLED TVs. It depends on what you really want to get, what kind of content you're watching. If you're watching sports on a Saturday afternoon with the lights on and the windows open, you're going to need a different or have a different standard than if you want to watch The Dark Knight in your living room at night with all the lights off.
All right, George, let's tackle the audio side next week. Surround formats, room correction, and what really matters in your living room. And speaking of audio, George, I want to remind our listeners about your online radio station. Of course, that's Otherside.live. It's George's freeform online music stream that rejects traditional radio formats in favor of music that is genuinely eclectic, thoughtfully curated, incredible variety across genres, eras, and styles. And I'm a listener. Encourage everyone to.
That's very nice. And to avoid FCC personal promotion thing, this free, it's a money loser for me, Craig. It's a labor of love, but it's a lot of fun. Thank you.
Entering its sixth year, right, George?
It is.
Yeah. That's Tech with Peck. George Peck joins us every Thursday on Main Street. Thanks, George.
All right. See you next week.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by LiveWire. providing live event audio, video, lighting, staging, and scenery for in-person, hybrid, and virtual events, serving clients throughout the Upper Midwest and nationwide. More at livewirenow.com.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public. Dave Thompson, our great news director here at Prairie Public, joins us as we review this week's news in North Dakota and the region. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Good to be here.
Dave, let's talk about a relatively significant natural gas increase now that's been filed with the North Dakota Public Service Commission.
Right. Xcel Energy is asking for a pretty substantial increase in its natural gas prices. Now, they're basically saying a lot of this is because they've upgraded their infrastructure, their gas lines, their gas production, and they need to recover that. They're asking for a more than 10% interim rate, which is okay because the state law says they can ask for an interim rate. And then it's almost a 12% increase in the monthly bills for the actual, you know, full rate case. It'll be interesting. I think the Public Service Commission is going to really look into this one, and it's going to be months before we decide where they decide whether what's going to happen, how much they're going to get.
This is the estimate is that it will cost North Dakotans about $120 a year for the average residential customer. That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. But, you know, NSP, you see that in North Dakota, Xcel Energy is still under Northern States Power Company, NSP. So sometimes I get in the old habit of saying NSP, but Xcel has basically said we haven't had a rate increase since 2023. It's time because we've done all this upgrading. So we'll watch how this one unfolds, and it's going to take a little while for it to unfold.
Let's keep kind of in the energy arena, Dave, if we could. North Dakota's approved battery storage sites, but there's a regulator now who is citing fire concerns.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't know there was concerns about fire, but fire is a possibility when you've got, you know, all this electronic equipment and battery storage. So he's saying that, you know, right now the companies are telling him that the risk is pretty small, and he agrees with that, but he would like more of a list of potential problems that would go along, what would come along with the next request for these battery storage sites. And then local firefighters can decide what they want to do and what local government's going to do.
Are these all across the state, Dave, or is it limited to just some counties?
Well, so far, it's been just a couple of counties, but I hear rumblings, and it's only rumblings right now, that there will be more of these, especially connected with wind farms, because that's how you're basically saying maybe wind can become that solid, you know, non-interruptible energy, because you can store some of the wind power in these batteries.
Dave, as of March 9th, North Dakota will have its newest member of its Supreme Court. Who is it?
Oh, he's Mark Fries from Fargo. Very good guy, very good resume. He's with one of the largest firms in North Dakota, the largest law firms. He was a Bismarck police officer back in the day. And, you know, he's going to take over a pretty good job because Daniel Carruthers, who is the Supreme Court Justice who is retiring, served 26 years. Governor Armstrong basically said this guy is good when he announced that he was being appointed.
Well, we wish him the best for sure in his appointment. Dave, there's been another case of measles in North Dakota. What's the latest?
Man, this is seven cases of measles now. And some of these are adults who are getting the measles. And it seems to be more in the northeastern part of North Dakota, but you worry about whether it's going to spread to the rest of the state. And so HHS is talking about measles vaccination, getting it, and doing the things to, you know, prevent yourself, you know, prevent it from catching it.
Dave, there are budget concerns that are now starting to become apparent for the next biennium. What do you know about it?
Although the state is okay in terms of what they've appropriated for the current biennium, which ends in July, there's some worry that, you know, some slowdown in oil, some slowdown in the farm economy, some slowdown in the sales economy might be hampering the tax collections for the next biennium. So state is looking at that. They're starting their revenue forecasting models, which will be available later this spring, to see what's going to happen. So again, there's no panic for now, but the next biennium, you may see some belt tightening.
There's a new wind farm that's being planned in Morton County, not far from where you live, and that wind power is scheduled to go to Minnesota.
Right.
Do I have that right?
You do, because Minnesota Power is building it. They're using the wind farms and the wind that blows in North Dakota to feed their customers in Minnesota, which is perfectly fine. It's a pretty large wind farm. It's over 200 megawatts, and it's going to take a while for that to run through the process. The Public Service Commission said the application is complete, but that's only step one. They have to go through hearings, they have to go through discovery, et cetera, before they come to a decision on that. It may take months.
That's Dave Thompson. He joins us on Thursdays here on Main Street. Dave, we hope you have a great weekend, and we'll look forward to chatting again.
Thank you, Craig. You too.
The Empire Theater Company in Grand Forks presents a new comedy for adults, The Nut Lab, by Kathy Cudell King, February 12th through the 21st. The play follows strangers in a nutrition study, each with personal motives and quirks, alongside the staff who oversee them. More information at EmpireArtCenter.com.
From Sitting Bull to Phil Jackson, from Prairie Dogs to Lefse, Dakota Datebook shares wild, weird, and wonderful stories that make North Dakota legendary. Strange towns, war heroes, Nephla soup, woolly caterpillars, and characters you won't believe once walked our streets. Listen to Dakota Datebook every weekday on your radio or wherever you get your podcasts. It's North Dakota's history, one incredible story at a time.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 19th. The state was still in the grip of winter when North Dakotans learned another hardship was on the horizon. On this date in 1934, they had grasshoppers on their minds. Just the day before, entomologists warned farmers to expect the worst grasshopper infestation in many years and that no part of the state was safe. Experts had surveyed fields in every county the previous fall, and the news was grim. Heavy infestations were found. The culprit was the migratory grasshopper, a close relative of the Rocky Mountain locust. Because these insects move from one community to another, experts stressed the importance of launching a coordinated control program. Grasshoppers can devastate crops and cause serious economic loss. The Great Plains endured hot, dry weather throughout the 1930s, creating ideal conditions for the pests. Between 1932 and 1939, grasshoppers caused millions of dollars in crop damage in Clay County alone. The Agricultural Extension Service went into action, developing plans and advising farmers. Dr. H.L. Walster of the Agricultural College gave public presentations recommending deep plowing of 4 to 6 inches. Eggs would still hatch, but the newly hatched grasshoppers would be too weak to reach the surface. Poisoning areas along fence rows and roadsides was also effective if done a few days after the first hatch. Grasshoppers that ate poisoned bran soon after hatching would not survive to damage crops. Early seeding was another strategy. When hay and forage were harvested, the grasshoppers naturally migrated into the grain. Grain planted early would be well matured by the time the grasshopper arrived, suffering less damage than later planted fields. When the North Dakota Agricultural College first opened, many farmers were skeptical that those college boys could teach them anything. Over time, they came to value the knowledge and guidance of the professors and their students. Despite initial skepticism, the mission of the North Dakota State University Extension Service continues today, providing programs that educate North Dakotans on all aspects of agriculture, including how to manage grasshoppers. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by NODAC Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at NODACINS.com.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's a replay of The Middle, which airs live tonight on Prairie Public at 7. Jeremy Hobson's topic is, how do you feel about America's foreign policy right now? At 7 p.m. Friday, we'll air Science Friday with Ira Flatow. From all of us at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again Monday right here on Main Street.